broadcasting before and probably after the rapture. It's the Drew Marshall Show.
I hurt myself today to see if I still feel. I focus on the pain, the only thing that's real. The needle tears a hole, the old familiar sting. Try to kill it all away, but I remember everything.
What a great song. Really, as far as I'm concerned, and it's a little pathetic, but one of the best Johnny Carson songs, Johnny Cash songs ever, and it happens to be near the end of his career. It's just something about the ache in his voice and how it aligns itself with this. The lyrics of this song, it was originally done by
Nine Inch Nails, Trent Reznor.
Very painful.
Even Trent Reznor says, this is no longer my song, this is his
song. Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. Big time.
Yeah. This is going to sound a little weird, but I imagine this song playing as they're deciding whether I go to heaven or not.
Maybe Johnny will speak on your behalf.
I hope so. Well, it's time to chat about an issue that sometimes it gets a lot of attention, and then it's like a blip in the radar, and then it gets none. Nothing. Do you guys talk about addictions a lot in school? I imagine you would. Being a school teacher?
Yeah, I think it's definitely, you know, kids trying to self-medicate, and, you know, the subject does come up. In drama, oddly enough, we were able to touch on a lot of really deep and penetrating subjects, you know, and this is definitely one of the ones we deal with, for sure.
Yeah. Well, a public health emergency was declared in British Columbia because drug overdose deaths have reached an average of 64 per month. I had to go back on that again and think, what? 64 per month. Got a lot of questions to ask a couple of people about that. Yeah. Joining us from British Columbia to discuss this and the legalization of marijuana, right? That'll probably come up in this conversation.
Yes.
Laura Lee Rosano, she is a recovering addict, alcohol and drug addictions counselor, and an author. 18 years ago, Laura Lee took the most difficult walk of her life through the front doors of a local treatment center. She found in recovery everything she'd been searching for in alcohol and drugs. Oddly enough. So, growing up in an alcoholic home, she understands firsthand the importance of a healthy family. Laura Lee has worked in the field of addiction for the past 16 years at the Edgewood Treatment Center in Nanaimo, BC. They make great squares.
Well, that's where they invented it.
Yeah. She is an author, mother, wife, foster parent, and friend. She has written a series of books on addiction, Jagged Little Edges, Jagged Little Lies, and soon to be released, Mick Jagged. No, Jagged No More. Laura Lee has also written a book for children who are growing up with addiction, Gracie's Secret, and she hopes that the honesty found in her books and blog will inspire addicts and their families to reach out for help. A website you may want to go to is jaggedlittleedges.com. Laura Lee, how are you?
I'm great, Drew, and what a title for my next book, Mick Jagged. Thank you so much for that.
No problem.
It's okay, man. You know, Mick's my best buddy. He'd love if you use that, man.
I'll let him know you said so. That's awesome. Thanks so much.
And also on the line, Dr. Vincent, he is the author of Diagnosing and Treating Addiction, an integrated look at substance use disorders and concurrent disorders. Dr. Vincent, you had a little time in Guelph, did you not?
That sounds kind of bad that I did time in Guelph, but yeah I did. Yes, I worked at the Homewood for almost 5 years, and that's where I got my first taste of working in addictions and a passion for that that's lingered on for many years.
Dr. Vincent is a licensed physician, registered with the College of Physicians and Surgeons of British Columbia since 1993, and a faculty member in the Addiction Psychiatry Division at University of British Columbia. He's a certified medical review officer with the American Association of Medical Review Officers, graduated medical school in 1932. So well done.
I guess that makes me pretty wise, eh?
Yes. Okay, a website I want to give to you folks right now is edgewood.ca, edgewood.ca, and especially for our listeners out there in British Columbia. Boy, I've got a lot of questions for you guys. So let's first of all talk about this public health emergency declared in British Columbia. 64 overdose deaths per month? What is going on, Dr. Vincent?
Well, I think the biggest change, and it's becoming a definite concern, is the increased potency of the drugs that are showing up on the streets. Now, we've gone from heroin, which was potent enough over the years, to the introduction several years ago of illicit fentanyl, which is a very potent opiate medication and therefore has a much higher lethality and toxicity. Also, it's not clear when people are using various drugs from street sources, because their quality control is not always the best, exactly what they're getting in the drug that they're purchasing from street sources. And you may have heard more recently is the W18 scare, which is 100 times more potent than fentanyl. So we've gone, you know, from a drug that a certain baseline to 100 times more potent drug with fentanyl to 100 times more potent drug with W18 when it starts to hit the street. So definitely a major issue.
Laura Lee, did you ever OD?
You know, I thought I was one time. My heart was going crazy, and I actually thought I was having a heart attack. I've witnessed an OD, but I've never actually overdosed myself, and there's never a really good time to be an addict, but I've got to say now, it's absolutely deadly. It's almost not if, you know, you're going to OD, it's like when. So it's pretty scary.
All right, so obviously we're not going to sit here and say, well, now, kids, stop using drugs. You know, remember the old commercial, yeah. this is your brain on drugs, right? The fried egg or whatever it is.
Yeah.
It just doesn't, I mean, nothing seems to be getting through. And even if we came out and broadcast through the streets on loudspeakers that, you know, all these overdose deaths are happening, and, you know, an average of 64 per month, up from 40 per month last year, despite a public health emergency called last month. Screaming and yelling and throwing up the flags and shooting up the flares, it doesn't help. It doesn't. So where do we even start?
Well, you've got to understand the mindset of an addict. As a matter of fact, if someone is truly addicted and they hear their friend down the street just found these drugs and they overdosed on them, they don't run away from those drugs. They run to them.
Yeah.
Because they know that they're extremely potent, and in their mind, they decide that, you know, they're going to use them. Just they'll go a lot farther, and, you know, it'll be a good financial decision. So it's we're not dealing with a rational mindset.
Okay, Dr. Vincent, I'm just reading a quote here. I wish I had the source. I think it might be HuffPost. Oh, sorry about that. I should have had that in front of me. Hope I don't get sued. I'm looking at there's a doctor with the last name Kendall, provincial health officer, Dr. Perry Kendall, who I'm sure you're aware of. Kendall says the declaration of a public health emergency has seen some positive results, including more awareness, more naloxone being given to drug-using patients when they are discharged from hospitals, and discussions at the municipal level to request supervised injection sites from Health Canada. So, are we starting to see a little bit of help here, or is it not making any dent?
Well, I think when you see a situation like this, there's different sort of philosophical approaches. One is you can look at prevention, but of course prevention is going to take a period of time. The other is what's the acute action that can be taken, you know, immediately to try and reduce the morbidity and mortality from these kind of concerns. And so one of the obvious things, if we can't prevent it immediately, is how can we respond by reducing the death and the toll. And so people have looked at how can we bring addicts into a more supervised or safe pattern of use, and that's where the safe injection sites come in. That's where using the naloxone take-home kits has come in, you know, which reverses or is an immediate antidote to an overdose. So,
right.
Addicts can be trained to, you know, treat their buddy who's near death beside them and save lives. And that's being demonstrated to save lives in the last several months.
The drug that they had to give Prince when he finished a concert, his plane went up in the air and they had to do an emergency landing, and apparently they injected him or gave him something, which is the stuff you give when someone ODs.
That would be exactly what they would have given. I don't know the specifics, but if that's what they gave him, it would have been naloxone.
Right, right, okay. Sorry.
What's called an opiate antagonist, or a drug that blocks the effect of the opiates.
All right. So apparently the data also shows that overdose deaths have jumped 320% since 2008. So that leads me to this question, Laura Lee. I look at this, we've got Meg's the intern here, and her and I have had a couple of discussions about the entitlement generation, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, her,
mm-hmm.
the kids these days, as Bill Cosby used to say in Jell-O commercials, although probably not a good name to reference while talking about drugs.
No, good, yes.
Anyway, is there something about the sucky nature of a generation of the most entitled generation that says, I can't get what I want, And what I want it now. And because I can't get it now, I need to cope somehow. I need to escape somehow. Laura Lee?
Well, you know, it seems the squeaky wheel is definitely getting the grease in 2016. I can say that with certainty. But, you know, we've got so many resources available. And I don't, you know, I'm not sure our help is really helping. And I don't know if it's because we're talking more about addiction or it's more out in the open. But it seems that, you know, I mean, we've never declared a crisis, a state of emergency before. So something needs to change. And I've got to say that answering the phones and talking to those people struggling with addiction who are needing beds and desperately seeking beds, and we don't have beds, and we're not opening, you know, we don't have beds to offer them through public funding. You know, that's one of the things I'd like to see change. Because, you know, while we're opening up more safe injection sites, I'm hoping that we're spending at least as much money funding beds and detox, because there are a lot of addicts that desperately want to get well, and in that wait, they're dying.
You know, I've never met someone who said, when I grow up, I want to be a junkie, right?
Right.
Exactly.
So obviously there's triggers and there's coping mechanisms that have not been developed. And so they reach out for something that medicates. And whether that's sex or drugs or rock and roll, I don't know. That's probably not the third one. But, you know, I guess I come back to when people want to reach out. What's the process? So let's say there's someone listening right now who's saying, you know what, I know I'm an addict, and I've been kind of really waking up lately as to the fact that I am an addict, but I don't know what my first step should be. Dr. Vincent, what's the first step?
Well, the first step is going to depend somewhat on the community that one is in and the resources that are available, but most communities will have access to a family physician, to an emergency room, to an alcohol and drug treatment outpatient program that people can go to, and there's AA communities and 12-step programs in most communities. So and reaching out to family members, you know, a lot of times family members would be desperately watching on the sidelines, just waiting for someone to say, I've got a problem, and get help, and they'll lead to their assistance. So generally speaking, if someone wants help, you're looking at one of the resources that's available to access, and there are many. The problem is generally not people, although there's a limited supply of residential beds and maybe detox beds in an area, but as far sure. as access to sort of basic frontline services, those are generally fairly available.
Okay, well, that would be sort of the scenario for someone who's had the wake-up call, right? They're sitting there going, you know what, true story, I am an addict. But there's so many steps before that, and Laura Lee, I mean, that was your journey. So there would be people sitting here listening to our show probably going, you know what, I take the odd thing here or there, but I'm not an addict, or I get hammered every once in a while, but I'm not an addict, or I have a couple of glasses of wine or drink or shot or whatever every night, but I'm not an addict, but I'm not an addict, but I'm not an addict. What was your journey towards realizing you were an addict?
Well, you know, I think I had moments in there where I thought, oh, my God. And I mean, one morning I woke up and I thought I had the flu, and someone suggested to me I was going through withdrawal, and it kind of hit me like a ton of bricks. You mean, because if I'm going through withdrawal, that means I'm an addict. And I didn't like that reality at all, so I quickly shoved it away and made excuses. But for anyone that really isn't ready to come to that conclusion or has come to it and did not accept it, you know, lots of times there's people in your life that are helping you stay very sick. And so as long as I have those people in my life to continue to enable me and make excuses for me and almost bear the consequences of my actions so I could continue on, you know, it was very easy to stay addicted. So when we talk about addiction, by no means am I saying that this is a singular illness. I think once we understand this is really a family illness, we've taken a giant step forward in getting help for everyone.
All right. Obviously, with this, you know, we're talking about addictions across the board. We're talking about drugs. We're talking about solutions. We're talking about government. What do they do? What don't they do? Mm-hmm. That the segue has to go now to legalizing marijuana. Are you two allowed to have an official opinion on this? Or because I think if anybody needs to have, or if you need to listen to anybody, it needs to be you guys. About marijuana, I'm not a user of marijuana. So Tim, you know, maybe you had a brownie one time or something. I don't know.
No, I want to try it.
All right. So, you know, you're talking to a couple of square middle class white dudes who, you know, it's, I don't know. It's not my scene. It's not, I'm not into it. I don't really give a holy grunt if somebody does it or not. In the back of my mind, I think, well, from what I've understood, if you're doing pot and not smokes, not cigarettes, maybe that's better for your body because it's a natural weed. That's the stuff I've heard. So, Dr. Vincent, how do you weigh in on the legalization of marijuana?
Well, I'm going to tell you, I have to differentiate perhaps my facility's opinion and my own opinion. So
yes.
I'm strictly speaking from my own opinion. I find it a very complex situation, to be honest with you. And I'll tell you some of the key things I look at. One is legalization. Are we talking for medical purposes or recreational purposes? If we're legalizing it, there are a number of potential concerns. And so one is, how do we measure impairment with marijuana for driving and employment kind of purposes? How do we protect vulnerable populations, in particular adolescents and those with various mental illnesses? Like we talked with opiates, where the forms and concentrations are increasing, we're seeing that with THC, which is the active ingredient in marijuana. So we've gone from 4% when you and I were kids to now 18 and 20%. And now we're getting into concentrates, which are up to 80% THC. So the drug itself and the way that it's available is changing. The second is, who provides THC, or medical marijuana, for example. So we wanted to make it, you know, available through commercial sources. But then there was a recent appeal here in BC, and people felt it was a violation of their rights not to be able to access marijuana cheaply and from a source that they choose. And so that was just thrown back to the government and said, yeah, you're right. You know, and so we are looking at that again. The other is accidental exposure of marijuana products with kids. So there's, you know, in Colorado, where they've legalized it, you know, they're finding there's more kids that are showing up in emergency rooms, particularly with eating edible products. We know that about 10% of people that start using marijuana become addicted to it, and the rates of that are probably double if you start as an early adolescent. And then there's various medical issues which haven't really been studied. And the problem is, we're looking at data and informed information to guide us in decision-making, but marijuana has been illegal in the U.S. and Canada, so how do you research a compound that's illegal to access and research in the first place? And we have this chaotic situation where federally marijuana is illegal, but in other areas it's being given locally. For example, in Vancouver here, where there's dispensaries that have approval from the city, even though federally it's illegal. So that's a quick way of sort of illustrating. It's hard to come down with a straight, you know, for me, a straight answer.
Sure.
And I think there's a lot of caveats, and I like the fact that the Liberal government is taking a gradual and slow, and they're not rushing into big decisions, because I think it is important.
Well, it is marijuana. You got to go slow, man.
Yeah, you stop to have munchies every once in a while.
Have a snack break every once in a while.
Exactly.
Laura Lee, you know, the three things that jump into my mind when it comes to the legalization of marijuana is, you know, it's yet another addictive substance. Is that true? And if it's true, then why would we legal? Okay, well, alcohol is addictive too. Okay, but is it more addictive? I don't know. And then there's the law of diminishing returns. What once used to kind of work for me eventually doesn't. So I gotta use more. That's true of all addictive substance. So you take more, and then you know. And I'm not gonna say the typical sort of right wing conservative, it's the gateway drug to hell or something. This is the real clincher for me. The people that I know who smoke the marijuana regularly, they're dopes. They're just dopey people. This is my anecdotal evidence. I got nothing else other than anecdotal.
Right.
The people I know that are potheads, there's a reason you call them potheads, because they are just dopey, slow. I don't know what else to say. They're dopey and slow. So help me chill on the marijuana thing.
Right. Well, you know what? Here's my take on it, and I'll just use my own experience and speak for no one else. But I was never afraid really to take a drink, and I mean, I'd seen it around the house, so alcohol was a very permissible thing in my growing up years,
right.
And it was something that was very normalized. And however, you know, I didn't find any pot around. And the first time I was offered to smoke pot, I was really scared to do it, and I turned it down. And the next time I was offered, I said yes. And that was my gateway into having less fear each time I was offered something higher than that. So I think once you conquer your fears as a young person, and that's really who I'm worried for here is our youth, because once you work through that fear place, you know, it's easier to make the decision to, okay, well, I smoked it, maybe I'll dab now, and you know, and just continue to climb into oblivion from there. So it's pretty easy to make those decisions once you've gone through that. And I think as a society, we've become almost overly permissive on a lot of things that just aren't really great for us these days.
Sure. Well, I think they're actually, this is going to sound like a joke segue, but the reality is they're cracking down on things like sugared cereal.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's not good for you. It messes you up big time, man. No, but seriously.
Frankenberry messed me up. Frankenberry was my gateway cereal.
Yes.
It was.
He's been dabbing that for years.
So, Dr. Vincent, if you were consulted by the Liberal government in regards to the legalization of marijuana and they gave you one point to make, one thing for them to consider, what would you scream out?
Boy, that's it's something related to safety in terms of access to the drug by adolescents and early 20s folks. Because, you know, I think when we look at safety around marijuana, you know, there are definitely some negative consequences. You outlined probably the commonest reasons that pure marijuana addicts come into treatment, and it's because they're not firing on all cylinders, they're underproducing, they're not living up to their potential as human beings academically or occupationally, and they are dumbed down, and then they notice cognitive side effects, which are mostly reversible, but are still there. And so the big concern is use by adolescents when the brain is still developing. The brain is still developing until mid-20s, and the biggest worry, if you read any of the medical sort of guidelines and concerns relate to medical marijuana, it's how do we protect this vulnerable group from getting actively involved and addicted before the brain fully matures.
Okay, well, I want to bring Tim on this because Tim is a high school teacher.
Yeah, for me, whether it's alcohol or drugs, you shouldn't be coming to school or work or anything with it on your breath, so to speak. My question is...
A radio show.
Yes, which especially. Now, this is more for the doctor rather than Lorelei. It's not that I'm trying to ignore you. But my question is, and you sort of alluded to it before, because it's always been so illegal, we haven't been able to experiment with it. But I've been hearing intriguing reports, and once again, you can't prove it because you're not allowed to use it. Are there medicinal, aside from glaucoma and, you know, maybe helping with pain or food appetite things, are there medical things that we can do? If you look at drugs in general, if you take any of these, you know, chemical compounds on their own, they could probably mess you up. But, right, you know, used in the proper way and used for the proper use, is there something about marijuana that can actually help society?
So we need to make a slight sort of clarification here. So we can look at marijuana in a smoked form, as a lot of people use it, or we can look at specific components that are in marijuana and what value do those have. So if we look at smoked marijuana, there have been benefits in terms of pain and people with chronic pain issues, in terms of helping pain and potentially reducing their use of narcotic painkillers. There has been use and utility for treatment of nausea and vomiting with chemotherapy and chronic other illnesses. There has, as you mentioned, there's been some interest in glaucoma. There has been use in end-of-life care for stimulating appetite and in particular in eating. And so there's those kind of areas. Then we can look at, well, what about specific compounds? So if we look at something called cannabidiol, which is one of the main constituents of marijuana, cannabidiol appears to be very beneficial for some conditions. And so paradoxically, it's actually being explored for its benefit with depression, with anxiety, with even psychosis, where we think of marijuana being a risk factor for psychosis, but cannabidiol, as opposed to THC, actually has some antipsychotic benefit potentially. So that means a long way of answering your question, but we do have to distinguish between marijuana as it's used and the plant source and the compounds that may be extracted and in fact may be very therapeutic.
All right, just before we say goodbye to you folks, I just want to let everyone know again, we're on the phone with Lorelei Rosano. She is a recovering addict. She is an alcohol and drug addictions counselor. She is also an author. A website you would want to go to find out more about Lorelei is jaggedlittleedges.com. And Dr. Merville Vincent, otherwise otherwise known as Mel, is the author of Diagnosing and Treating Addiction, an integrated look at substance use disorders and concurrent disorders, and a website for him and organization that he's involved with, edgewood.ca. Okay, we've got you both on the phone. We've asked our little selfish questions. What do you guys really want to say? Laura Lee, what do you want to say just in closing?
Yeah, I just like to speak to your listeners, whether you love someone who is struggling with addiction or whether you're struggling with it yourself. I want you to know that nobody with addiction disorder is a bad person, and they are sick, and it would be like having cancer. So the best thing you can do for someone you love or yourself is start that conversation ball rolling. Andrew, I think you've got a number for us, but get curious. Pick up the phone, give us a call. Change your life, and I mean, it can happen that quickly. I had no idea, walking through the doors of a treatment center almost 19 years ago, that just that step forward would change my life into where it is today. So that's what I'd like to leave you with, some hope. Pick up the phone and start that process happening for yourself.
And here's the phone number for you, 1-800-683-0111. 1-800-683-0111. What's going to happen when someone phones this number, Laura Lee?
Well, they're going to get an answer on the other line. We have someone answering 24/7. And what they're going to do is they're going to talk to that person answering the phone about what's going on in their life. And that person on the other end will try to get some resources starting or applicable to help them, you know, in a different direction. So they'll get the help they need if they call that number.
So this is somebody who says, you know what, yeah, I'm thinking maybe I do have an addiction problem. Mm-hmm. I need to reach out. This could be my first step. Is it anonymous?
Well, you know what? No, because we need to know, where do you live? What kind of help do you need? There needs to be a little bit of an assessment done on the phone, because we don't want to give people the wrong direction.
Right.
So, you know, but certainly if the person says, hey, I haven't even told my family, like, what would you suggest? At least it's a link somewhere where they can make that call and say, I need help. I don't know what to do. I'm not even sure if I'm ready to take that help, but I'm going to start the conversation.
And anybody from any province can call this number?
You bet, yeah.
1-800-683-0111. 1-800-683-0111. I'll say it again. 1-800-683-0111. Laura Lee.
That's all I wanted to say. You know, it can be from anywhere all over Canada, and, you know, and one phone call can really change your life.
Dr. Vincent, final word?
I would just, in response to your geographic question, I just wanted to highlight the fact that even though Edgewood is a 120-bed facility in Nanaimo, we are now Edgewood Health Network, and so we have outpatient offices where people can go for help in Victoria, Vancouver, Calgary, Toronto. We own a facility called Bellwood in Toronto, and another one in Montreal. So we're now national. We look at a continuum of care. We look at intervening early and do everything from outpatient assessments that you talked about, how do you go for help and ask for it, through to very intensive residential treatment. So
brilliant.
The number is 1-800-683-0111 for anybody needing help along any of those things.
Dr. Vincent, thank you. Laura Lee, Rosano, thank you to both of you. I really appreciate this segment. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having us.
Bye-bye. All right, folks, a short break, and we'll be back very soon with Michael Korn. He is the author of Epiphany, A Christian's Change of Heart and Mind Over Same-Sex Marriage. Stay with us.